Blog Talk Radio.
There's a direct relationship between having the businesses and being in prison. Go find an Asian, see how many Asians you can find in American prisons. They ain't going to be in there. But 51% of your prison will be black because blacks don't have any businesses and industries. There's a direct link. Blacks won't practice group economics. Blacks won't practice group politics. If you don't practice, you're setting yourself up. I told that five-story building, you're setting yourself to get wiped out. Understand the nature of race, which is economics. If you build the first floor, it's economic. Build your businesses and your industries. Control buildings and industry, and put that pulls in your money, and hold that money, and practice group economics with it. Arab and Asian money bounces 12 or 13 times for at least. Jewish money bounces 18 times. Black folks got to learn how to practice group economics. Black Americans spend every penny they get outside their own community. Then you take the money and the wealth that you get from that first floor and go to the second floor. The second floor is politics. You then take that money on the first floor and you control your politics. Black folk must quit allowing people to tell them to go out and vote. Vote for what? Nobody's going to do anything for black folk in politics. Politics is controlled by money. Major corporations, who got the money? That's what controls politics. If you have no money, you have no say-so, you have no benefits coming. So you take your money and you control and you take your money on the first floor, you buy every politician on the second floor. And any politician you can't buy, you rent or lease them to get what you need. Then once you get the second floor under control with the politician, with your money, then you go to the third floor. The third floor then is the police department and the court system. You take your money from the first floor and your politics on the second floor and you control the court system and the police department. Then the fourth floor, then is media. You then take the money that you generate off the first floor from business and industries and you go after radio stations, TV stations, newspapers, and cable systems so that you can now inform and communicate with your own people. Right now, black folk own and control less than...
So this is my house. I don't know what to do.
Oh my God!
Now to the humanitarian crisis unfolding in Texas and Mississippi. Millions are still without running water, and in other areas, the water is not safe to drink. Trucks are bringing in water for residents in Jackson, Mississippi, and in Houston, lines for drinking water and food. Late today, the city lifted its boil water alert, but thousands of customers remained without power. Reports are now coming in about people hit with sky-high electric bills, some for thousands of dollars. ABC's Trevor Ault is on the ground for us in Houston.
Tonight, 1 week after those devastating storms first hit Texas, reality is setting in.
We heard it like a like it was just gushing. That's when we noticed that was down.
All up here?
Yes.
Brianna Bolden showing us her grandmother's home in ruins. The pipes bursting under pressure from the freezing temperatures, leaving the ceiling collapsed and her grandmother heartbroken.
Like every time she walked in there, she'll look up and she'll just be like, and she'll just walk up in her room and close her door.
And as you see, no running water at all.
Tonight, Houston finally lifting their boil water orders, but problems still remain across Texas and beyond. Elwin Lopez is in hard-hit Mississippi.
Here in South Jackson, 70% of people are without running water. The city providing this 5,400-gallon tanker just to be able to provide people with water to flush their toilet.
Thank you.
And as more stories emerge of people freezing to death inside their homes, the family of 11-year-old Christian...
Many a young athlete entertains hoop dreams. Few, if any, have tried as hard to make them come true as the kid our Steve Hartman has gone to see.
Every week, he set himself up for disappointment. Every week, 13-year-old Jamarian Stiles came to this community center in Boca Raton, Florida, hoping to play basketball with the other kids. And every week, he was rejected.
They'll start picking teams, and I would be the only one left out. And then they'll just tell me, just go home and stuff. You can break someone's heart like that.
The problem was obvious to everyone but Jamarian. He lost his hands and most of his arms as an infant due to a rare bacterial infection. But he insisted that was no reason to give up his hoop dreams.
What about soccer? Have you heard of that sport?
Yeah, hear it every day.
Why don't you play soccer? That just seems like the obvious thing.
You would think that I would be good at soccer. I'm really not. I'm horrible.
Which is why, on the first day of class here at Eagles Landing Middle School, Jamarian took his case to basketball coach Darian Williams.
Yeah.
Said he wanted to be on the team this year.
I said, all great, well, just make sure you try out.
He said, okay, great, but what are you really thinking?
This man has no arms.
Yeah.
How is he going to play basketball? But man, he told me, Mr. Williams, I've never been on a team before. Even if I don't play, I just want to be on the team. And how could I say no to that?
And that's how the Eagles got their first armless basketball player. Jamarian, number two there, quickly earned a reputation as the hardest worker on the squad.
He was usually the first one in the gym, usually the last one to leave.
Still, he sat on the bench most of the season.
Try one more.
Until last month. Coach put him in the game with about 6 minutes left. And when he eventually got the ball on the far side of the court, everyone yelled, shoot it! So he did. And sank. A three-pointer. And if you didn't quite see that, don't worry. Because shortly after, he got the ball again. This time on the near side. For another three-pointer. At the buzzer. Jamarian Stiles. The kid no one would pick. Was now everyone's hero. Needless to say, today, Jamarian can play all he wants at the community center. He just made the volleyball team and has every intention of playing football next year. Really, the only thing he won't play is the victim.
If I could wave a magic wand right now and give you your arms back, would you want them?
I don't need them.
You don't need them?
No.
Who needs hands when you've got this kind of touch?
Now learn this from Joel Osteen. That's my man. He be texting me. That's my man. This God done put some people around me, show me some stuff. He was telling this story. He said, this man that went to heaven, he was walking with Peter down this aisleway, and was going down this corridor, had a lot of doors on it, and said all these doors had names on it. And he said, Peter, let me ask you something. What's all these doors, these names on? He said, don't worry about it, just go ahead. So he kept walking. And messed around, he saw one of them doors and had his name on it. He said, whoa. He said, hey, Peter, this here ain't got my name on it. Something I need to know? He said, man, don't worry about that. You here now. Just go on in there and talk to him. See what he said, nah, I want to know what's in the door. He said, you sure you want to see what's in the door? He said, yeah. So he opened up the door. It was a warehouse. It had number shelves on it. And then the shelves had nothing but packages. And all the packages had his name on them. And he said, what is all these boxes? He said, that's all of the blessings, all of the things God wanted to ship to you. But number one, you didn't ask him for it. Then number two, you didn't believe you would have it. Then you doubted him. And then you felt like you wasn't worthy. And so now all these boxes is up here. Now the man standing there wishing he had never even been in the room. And I started thinking. I got some dudes that work for me. And I said, I want you to do this graph for me. And that's what I'm finna show you now. See, what you happen is, when God sends your package, he only sends it to one street. That's Faith Street. You got to stay in faith. You can't move off of Faith Street. You can't get on Doubted Drive. You can't be over there and start doubting it because your package going to go right on by. You can't lose your faith and get on Not Meant to Be Way because your package is going to keep going right on by. Because the package just go to Faith Street. You can get your little feelings hurt, I ain't worthy. Guess what? Your package going to keep going right on by. You have not because you ask not. Then you sit up here and start feeling sorry for yourself. You go on pity way, your package keep going right on by. If you stay right on Faith Street, don't ever come off because the blessing is coming. If you wait on it, here it comes. It may not come when you want it, but it on time. But if you get up and you move off of Faith Street, your box going to get sent back to sender. And now you're going to have a warehouse with a bunch of boxes with your name on it that you didn't never get. And I don't know about you, but I want everything he got for me. If he got something for me, I need all of mine. Because I don't know about you, but God lay you out, man. God will give you stuff. Man, he done took me places. I ain't never thought I was going to go. I done seen parts of the world I never even thought I could go to. He done gave me stuff. He done put people in my life. God will do it for you, man. But you just got to stay, man. Use these principles of success. Understand, God is just that way. He'll lay you out. Because if he can lay me out, see, if he fix me and change me and get me over here trying to do better, I ain't perfect. I'm just trying to do better. I still say some stuff I ain't supposed to say. You understand? I ain't got it all together yet. I just got in the gate. I'm a new kind of Christian. But ain't no lock on my gate either. So if you see, once you check me, I'm probably going to check you back. But I'm getting better at that. I don't know how to love my enemies yet. I'm getting better at it, though. But it's a process. And the more times we can make people understand that it's a process, the more people can come in. And y'all people that have been good to me, that have been praying for me. I mean, man, my mama, if she could see me now, I just wish my mama could see me. Because she's been praying for this hill all her life. Watch my son. Well, he done watched me, mama. And I'm cool now. And my philosophy is very simple. I was who I was, but I am who I am. And I'm cool with both them people. Because who I was wasn't that bad cap. I made some mistakes, but I've been changed a little bit. And it's still a process. And the more people that you invite into the process, the better this is. Because ain't nobody perfect no how. So I really appreciate y'all, man, hearing me and listening to me. I'm going to ask Kirk Franklin if he will come.
All right. Morning Motivation. Today's podcast is titled Housing Distinctions, Mobile Homes versus Real Estate. Many people confused. Well, yeah, I don't know if Kareem confused. Well, think that mobile homes are real estate. And actually, another title for this program could be Housing Distinctions, Personal Property versus Real Estate. Mobile homes are considered, now mobile homes is a distinction of housing, but it's not real estate. It's personal property, and I think personal property is better than real estate. I'm going to some of those reasons why, as I point out those distinctions. But first, let's take a listen to this particular audio from an 11-year-old. I think she's 12 years old now.
Well, you've heard the phrase, one man's trash is another man's treasure. Well, Steve Shives knows it's true. He's made a fortune thanks to some old scrap parts from a beat-up bus, and it all became a million-dollar business.
Steve Shives turned his backyard business into a million-dollar company in under 5 years.
I'm doing something that I love. I enjoy the fact that people appreciate it.
It wasn't always that way. When Steve and his wife Deirdre married, he was an unpaid associate pastor who earned money as a handyman.
I just couldn't quite make enough. And with that struggle, we started using credit cards.
I would use a credit card to buy groceries, put gas in the vehicle, and it wasn't just one credit card.
Before long, they were carrying $30,000 of debt.
I think we were just irresponsible in a lot of ways, in the ways that we spent money, because we still tithed. We were still faithful in our giving. In my mind, we were being good stewards by giving 10%. What I didn't know is that we were being bad stewards of the other 90.
When creditors started calling, Steve and Deirdre say they knew it was time to take a hard look at their finances.
I had this anger inside myself. You're the pastor of a church, and you're teaching people on tithing, and you know, how in the world did you let this happen? And I said, God, I said, if you'll help me get out of this debt, I will never be in debt again, and I'll be faithful to whatever it is you give me.
Steve says that's when the Lord told him to cut his spending, increase his giving, and to tithe on the amount he needed to support his family.
God said, so if $1,000 a week is what you want, then $1,000 a week is what you have to sow towards.
I thought, well, if this is going to help us, and this is what God's told you to do, then we need to do it.
Steve began to work with their creditors to pay down their debt. Several companies gave him the option to settle for far less than he owed. With their debt reduced, the couple increased their giving again.
As we just began to prosper, you know, we'd give more and more, like, okay, give $150 this week.
Steve says that's when he learned that good stewardship can mean implementing an idea that comes from God.
I got the idea for building this little camping trailer. I built it and sold it on eBay in a day and a half. I started getting messages from people saying, would you consider building another one?
The company Runaway Campers was born. Within 3 months, they sold 9 more campers. The following year, they sold 140. To date, more than 1,500 people have bought one of Steve's trailers. Many weekends, Steve and Deirdre attend rallies to meet people who bought the campers. And when they do, they're quick to tell them about what God has done in their lives.
And they're like, tell me the story. And I start telling the story, and I've told it hundreds of times. We can say, look at what God has done in our life, not because we're living the American dream or we're making lots of money, but look at the joy that comes when you really just totally give yourself to God. He'll give you more, so much more than you could ask or imagine.
Just look at the joy when you give yourself totally to God. Here's the promise from Matthew 25. To those who use well what they are given, even more will be given, and they will have an abundance. But from those who do nothing, even what little they have will be taken away. And Steve walked that out. Here he is, a pastor. He's teaching tithing. He's living tithing, but he comes to the realization, I'm not doing right with the other 90%. I'm living beyond my means. I've got to bring that into line. And then God gives him a wonderful idea, and he says, that's a great idea. Let's start walking that out. And that simple idea turns into a $1 million business, which is absolutely incredible. To those who use well what they are given, even more will be given. So just resolve you're going to use well what you have, and you're just going to watch God, watch over His word to perform it and perform it in your life.
Also tonight, the incredible transformation and the Buffalo Strong spirit that made it all happen. 7 Eyewitness News reporter Taylor Epps shows us how a young lady has completed her very own renovation project.
11-year-old Lauren Nelson had big plans for her summer.
I thought it was going to be pretty fun, but with COVID going on, it was going to be not as fun as it could be.
But things changed one day when she was flipping through an American Girl doll magazine at her home in Attica.
And she showed us a $650 VW bus. My husband was like, that's ridiculous. You could buy your own camper for that price.
So she did just that. Lauren saved some money and started looking. A neighbor just down the road had this 20-foot camper that caught her eye.
And then the one day, up popped a for sale sign, and she squealed the whole way home.
And she started negotiating.
It wasn't very hard. He said $500, and I said $400 because that was the money that I had in my bank account, and he said sold.
Then it was time to renovate.
It was a process. We brought home a family of mice. And so there was a lot of deep cleaning,
but that didn't stop her.
I was very motivated because I really wanted a place where I could just, like, hang out like my own house.
The whole renovation process took Lauren about 2 months, and with the help of family and friends, she was able to turn this into this.
It's called Camp Hygge. It means very comfortable and safe. It has its own kitchen and bathroom, so it's like a tiny house.
So now you're the owner of a tiny home at 11 years old.
Yes.
The whole project cost her $800.
She has 3 envelopes that she puts her money in, give, save, and spend. I think she made a really good choice. She now says she's part of the tiny home nation.
She was able to turn her summer around and hopes to inspire others to do the same.
Which is awesome to see that somebody who's 11 years old had her own vision but now is out there and other people are contacting us and they've gone out and bought a camper to do the same thing. If you're looking to have some big plans in the future, you should go out and do it. Make it happen.
In Attica, Taylor Epps, 7 Eyewitness News.
Hi, I'm Stephen Shives, and people often ask me about how Runaway Campers got started as a business, and so many times I tell the story, and maybe I oversimplify it at times, because it honestly has been a lot of work for the past almost 5 years now, and so, you know, when we got started, I'm actually standing here next to the very first runaway camper prototype, as I called it back then. I never honestly intended to build another one. You know, it was just kind of built out of necessity, and so I've been fortunate enough to be able to buy this back from the second owner this past year and be able to have this as kind of a memory maker. But you know, when I first built it, I wasn't even thinking about starting a business. I was just doing what I needed to do to support my family. And I was rebuilding a transit bus at the time, and I needed a transmission for one. And I actually found another identical transit bus that the body was just all shot, but it had a good motor and transmission. So I bought it and I took it back and I took the motor transmission out of it and then I went to the scrapyard to get rid of what was left, and the scrapyard refused it. He said, I can't take that. There's more fiberglass on that thing than there is metal. So I took it back home and my wife was like, what are you doing? Where's that? I thought you were taking it away. And I said, no, they wouldn't take it. So the best I could figure to do is I'm going to take a saw and chop it up into small enough pieces that I can take it off to the dump. And while I was doing that, I started doing some measurements, and I realized I had a wall section there with 3 windows that was just slightly over 8 feet long. And I thought, what can I build out of that section of windows? I mean, they're nice, solid RV windows, a good solid wall section, and it's an even 8 feet. I can make something out of that standard measurement. And so that's where this was birthed out of. I mean, it was just, that's where the three windows are, and that's actually the side walls of that bus. It's the first and only unit that we ever built with three windows on each side. And some people ask us, well, will you build another, or, you know, why don't you do that anymore? It was just something that was done out of necessity. And out of that was a business that was birthed that a lot of people, you know, refer to it as the American dream, you know, the backyard business startup that, you know, with American ingenuity and the opportunity that we have in this country to basically be anything we want to be and share our ideas with, you know, with those around us. And so it's been a tremendous blessing. And I think back and I think, you know what, if that scrapyard would have taken that old junk bus when I took it in there the first time, Runaway Campers wouldn't be here today. And so often we don't see around the next corner in life. We don't always realize that some of the stumbling blocks or roadblocks that we come up upon in life are there that guide us or steer us in a different direction that we've yet to see yet. And so I'm grateful for some of the things that have happened that have kind of moved us in different directions over the years, some of the bumps and bruises that we've had. I share some of those stories in a short book that I wrote called Breaking Camp. So if you want to hear the whole story, be sure and grab a copy of that. I hope you enjoy it. But, you know, the most exciting thing about this journey has been the people. We're excited to be a part of hundreds and hundreds of people's lives over the past few years as we've grown and stretched with this business. We continue to research and do the best that we can to continue making a better and better product all the time for the money that you spend. And so, you know, the camper we built in the beginning was not the camper that we built when we built the first 10. And then after the 10, things changed. And after 20 and 40 and 50, things changed. And now after over 1,000 units, we just continue to make changes along the way to offer our customers the very best product for the money. And so we're excited about that. We're glad to be a part of so many people's lives and to realize that what a blessing it is. That when you invest in a Runaway Camper, you're not just investing in your own enjoyment. You're not just investing in something that you're going to use for pleasure on the weekends every now and then. You're investing in the American dream. You're investing in what this nation was founded on, the opportunities that we have to press forward through our ideas and through our circumstances and the dreams that we have to make the most of the life that we have to live. And so you're investing in that. You're investing in the lives of the families that build these campers, that it supports their families. And you're investing in communities, in our own community, and in the charities that we support. You're investing in work that we do in foreign countries to help impoverished children and families. And so we're grateful for that and for the part that our customers play in that as well as the support and the prayers that come in and the encouragement. Many times relationships we get cards, we get letters and emails and phone calls on a regular basis of people telling us how much the Runaway has enhanced their life, that it's allowed them to meet new people and make new friends, and they even have a marriage on the books now because a couple met through their Runaway campers. And so we're excited to be part of people's lives, and we're excited that we can share it with you as well. And so stop in and see us at our sales center in Central Florida, or maybe we'll run into each other in the out when we're out and about at a campground or a shopping center one day. But I hope you have a great day, and I hope the story encourages you to keep pressing through in everything in life and make it the very best that you possibly can. God bless you. Talk to you soon.
Welcome to Camp Hugay.
This 11-year-old spent her summer turning the inside of this camper from this to this.
I was looking through an American Girl magazine, and I saw a camper for $650 for an American Girl, and it was a very nice camper. My dad said that was really expensive for us, so he said that we could get a real camper for that amount of money. So then I went out and I started looking for one. We saw down the road a house had a camper for sale that I had been looking at for a while. So I really wanted to get it, and the guy said it was for $500. And then I told him $400 because that was what I had. And he said sold.
And the total cost of renovations thus far? $400.
We had looked on Pinterest and saw a lot of cool camper ideas. And I liked this beachy boho style with lots of plants and different colors and sea glass and driftwood, that style. So I liked that, and we decided to paint the camper walls white and then our kitchen cabinets turquoise. So this is my dining area. I got this from our potting shed that had dust and dead flies all over it, so we cleaned it up and that's what we got. We planted some plants from Dollar General in there. We have all of this on the backside came from our house except for that one picture back there from Dollar General. And a fun fact about these, this table and these cabinets, they flip down into a bed, and so does this. And then over here we have the kitchen where we can't quite cook stuff yet, but it's very decorative. And this is our refrigerator, the inside of it. And then if we walk a little further down, we have right here, these are very nice decals that we got for a dollar at the Dollar Tree. And then if we walk a little bit farther in here, we have a mirror that we painted the edges that came with the camper originally. And we have a closet over here, and it says Lauren's little camper. I got this sign from my neighbor who made it for me. And then we keep walking, and now we're in the bedroom. So we have four beds in here, and we got these really cute mattresses off of Etsy.
She painted most of it herself. She had her grandma come over the one day and help with the cupboards, but I would be gone for the day, and I'd come home, and she'd say, like, you could tell, and I'd say, how long were you in here? And she's like, oh, I painted about 4 hours straight.
Well, I'm very creative and artistic, so I love to paint and draw and stuff like that, so it kind of came to me naturally.
With this COVID thing, it's kind of interrupting her fun that she wants to have in it, but she's making the best of it.
Lauren hopes to be able to have friends over soon, but a chance to get away from home works for now.
I hope you enjoyed my camper tour. Thanks for stopping by.
This is Inside Edition Digital.
Hi, folks. In this video, I'd like to talk about how to have a home with no house payments and no monthly utility bills. You may think that's not possible, but I do it, and lots of other people do it as well. I'm going to show you how it can be done, how it can be done very inexpensively, and just kind of give you some ideas for things that you can do that society and the economic powers that be don't want you to know. So stay with me for a second, and let me walk you through this. First, you need some land. This is my piece of land, which is under an acre, about 3/4 of an acre. And that's really all you need to take care of most of the needs you have and for running a small homestead. Now, I was lucky enough to get this piece of property from family. It was willed to me when my father passed away. But I have also purchased small pieces of property like this for under $400. I have an acre down in Arizona near Sholo, Arizona that I purchased for under $400. I have 5 acres near El Paso, Texas that I purchased for under $700. So it's very easy to find a piece of land if you do some looking around. eBay is a good source for finding land. Tax sales are a good source for finding land. Family members may want to sell off a piece of land. Go around looking in rural areas, and maybe you'll find a farmer that wants to split off a small piece of land and would gladly sell you one. You don't have to spend a lot of money on land, okay? This is land that doesn't have utilities run to it. It doesn't have a blacktop road that runs into it or driveway. It's rough land. That's what you start with usually if you want to buy a small piece of land that you're going to homestead on. After you have your piece of land, then you're going to have a house. You can have a big house like most people live in, and you can pay a lot of money for it and have a mortgage and be a slave to the system for another 30 years, or you can decide if you'd like to build a smaller house like mine. Paid for with cash. This is my solar cabin. The cabin cost me $2,000 to build. That does not include the doors and windows, which I salvaged off of a trailer that was being torn down. For the cabin, it cost me $2,000. It is 14 by 14. Downstairs is living area, dining area, bathroom, kitchen. Upstairs, I have a loft, bedroom, and an office. In my other videos, I take you on a complete walkthrough of this cabin, so watch those if you want to see how the cabin is as large as it is and functional on the inside. Up there on my roof, you see my solar panels. That's a 350-watt solar system that provides all of my electricity needs for lights, TVs, water pumps, all miscellaneous gadget, laptop, TV, run my vacuum, and everything else off of a 350-watt system. That 350-watt system cost me under $3,000. $2,000 for the cabin, $3,000 for the power system of solar electricity, and I use propane. I have a propane tank in the back of the cabin, and I have a propane furnace, fridge, stove, and on-demand water heater, and those cost me just about $200 for an entire year. And we have cold winters here, folks. Under $200 for an entire year for all of my propane. That is the only utility bill I have. I do not pay for electricity. I do not pay for water because I drilled my own water well. Before I drilled my own water well, though, I hauled water in. But drilling a water well on a piece of property is not that hard. You can either do it yourself or hire somebody to do it. So I have no monthly utility bills. I have a house that's completely paid for. And I have freedom. A freedom that you can't get when you're under the pressure of a mortgage and utility bills. I want you to take just a minute and think about what you could do with your life if you had no house payments and no utility bills. And I'm telling you, it is completely possible. I'm not going to go into any details of how to get out of the house that you're in. You're going to have to figure that out and talk to some professionals for some help that way. All I'm here to do is tell you it's completely possible. Now, some of you are looking at the cabin and saying, yeah, but I couldn't possibly live in anything that small. This cabin was designed specifically for additions to be built on any of three sides. As you can see, the cabin has no windows on any of the three sides. There is a window in the back door glass. The sides are 14 by 14. The cabin was built to have shed additions built on all three sides. This cabin is 400 square feet approximately inside, with 200 square foot footprint. When you add on additions, you could add on an additional 400 square feet on either side and off the back, giving you anywhere from 800 to 1200 square feet. The great thing about building a small cabin to start out with, though, is it gives you a place to live when you build on your additions, and that way you can wait and live very cheaply without any house payments or utility bills. And then when you have the money, you can build on the additions to expand the cabin. That's very good for a single person or a young couple who don't have children, because you don't need a whole lot of space to start off with. This way you can save for it, build on as you want to, have the additions, have the extra room if that's what you want. Now, I live full-time in this cabin. I live by myself, but my girlfriend comes up here on the weekends, and we stay together, and let me tell you, it's perfectly comfortable. We don't feel cramped at all, and we'd much rather have a small place like this. It takes a lot less money to heat, takes a lot less money to cool, it's a lot easier to clean, it's just a fantastic home. Now, I'm not trying to push you into building a home exactly like mine. I'm just trying to provide you with some ideas. If you wanted to come up with different ideas, a different plan, that's just fine by me. But if you are interested in learning how to build a home like mine, I do have an ebook available and a printed book available called Simple Solar Homesteading. Go to www.simplesolarhomesteading.com. You can learn how to build a cabin like mine, or at least get some great ideas for building your own home. Now, I want to repeat, I own my land. I have a house that I built for under $2,000. I have a solar electric system that I have for under $3,000. I use propane, which costs me under $200 a year. I have no house payments. I have no utility bills. If you want a life like this, it is very possible. You can stop listening to the media, and you can stop being put under society's pressures to live in the type of houses that everyone tells you you have to live in. You can live very inexpensively, and you can do this at an age, at any age, whether you're older or younger. If you're younger and you start in a place like this, imagine the amount of money that you would have to retire on, with no house payments, no utility bills, and freedom. Thank you for joining me, folks. Please watch the rest of my videos for more detailed information on each of the systems and a complete walkthrough of the cabin.
Imagine living in a space that measures a mere 168 square feet, more than 14 times smaller than the average American home. Well, it is here inside this tiny house where the proud owners are discovering that less is so much more.
Well, in the past year, we've managed to save everything that I earn. We use my husband's income for our living expenses, and I've been teaching public school, so that's about $3,000 a month that we've put in the bank this year.
Hari, her husband Carl, and their two young kids Archer and Ella recently celebrated their one-year anniversary in their tiny house. After losing their 1,500-square-foot home to financial struggles, the couple took matters into their own hands, literally. They built this space themselves with just $13,000 in materials. Their goal? To become debt-free and save enough to one day build a new home, mortgage-free. And so far, they're right on track.
Things are going really well with the next project. We're going to build a 16 by 24 unit to begin with, and then we'll branch off of that and add bedrooms.
You may remember seeing this family on The Anderson Show earlier this year, where I joined them on stage. Fascinated by their story, our financially fit team flew down to Virginia to see for ourselves and learn ways we can all downsize.
How are you? Hey, really good.
You. Hey there. Living in the tiny house has taught me that we don't need much at all to be happy, and that getting the things that we need can actually be a lot of fun.
Can you get me a bowl and some scissors?
The family's fruit and vegetable garden lets them eat healthier, cut down on their carbon footprint, and slash their grocery bill by as much as 30%. Hari has also been upcycling, as she calls it, taking something old and breathing new life into it.
My favorite upcycling project was the rugs I made for the house. I took old sheets, flat sheets, and crocheted them into rugs. They're beautiful and they fit the house a lot nicer than if we had gone and bought something new from the store.
The couple also recently switched jobs, not for more money, but more happiness. Carl is enjoying better working conditions at a new restaurant, and Hari left teaching to pursue a career in nonprofit. Being able to afford a career that you love and pursuing a passion rather than a paycheck, they've learned, is just an added benefit to having savings and no debt.
I'm probably taking a 25 to 30% cut in my salary, which is going to enable me to have more time to actually build the house and save money because I'll be the contractor.
It's really a great feeling to be able to make a decision like that, not based on money, but based on what we want to be doing with our time.
The kids also seem keen to the transition. Mom and Dad are happy to report fewer requests for video games or toys now that Ella and Archer are busy playing outdoors on their 3-acre property.
We play down by the creek and up at the big tree up there where the swing is. We play with our neighbors and ride bikes.
There's a lot of different things they can do with their time besides play with plastic toys and get online.
They've really just embraced it wholeheartedly. You can't stop them from having a good time outside.
Still another lesson, when you downsize, it helps to have a support system.
There's such a wealth of knowledge in our community, and that helps us a lot. And having that support makes it like we're doing it together. Moving to the country has given us a lot of things, not just the tiny house.
So, what do you think? What are your thoughts about living in a tiny house? Would you ever do it? Connect with me on Twitter at Farnoosh and use the hashtag FinFit. For Yahoo Finance, I'm Farnoosh Tarabi.
And today's podcast is titled Housing Distinctions, Mobile Homes versus Real Estate. Now, in every last one of the audios that we played today, there are examples of private or personal property. Campers are, well, first thing, there's a couple of lessons out of that, with the one with Laura Nelson, who was 11 years old. She's 12 years old now. Bought it for $400. She's Generation Z. That's what they're doing. They're looking at, Generation Z are looking at their parents and grandparents, and in some cases great-grandparents, and say, look, you know what? I'm not getting into a 30-year mortgage, and I'm not getting hit with property taxes. So by the time, actually, Laura's already achieved it at 11. She's 12 years old now. So she's got a place to stay. Debt-free, you know, no mortgage on it or nothing like that. So you have, and that's why I love YouTube as a barometer, because you have people mostly older than her, you know, 12 years old, 13 years old, 15 years old, 16 years old. They're doing the same thing. They're building their own housing, which as long as it's not permanently attached to, and that's the distinction, between personal housing, personal property that which acts as housing, and real estate. Personal, like the camper example, like the runaway campers with Steve Shives, with the solar cabin with Lamar Alexander, those are examples of housing, all legally classified as personal property, but none of them were real estate. The distinction is, once you attach any of those, particularly the cabin that Lamar Alexander built, or the tiny house family built, all of those were examples of housing. Was not permanently attached to the ground, so they're housing. And you can call them campers, cabins, whatever you want to call it. But once you permanently attach it to the ground via cement slabs, that type thing, then it converts into real estate. Then your de facto senior partner is the local taxing authority, and they will tax it every year. They will send you a tax bill every year. You don't pay that tax bill, then they can auction the house off and sell it to somebody else. So not everybody's not on that bandwagon, but many are, and I think it's a safer way to go just to have your housing, or even if you want to be a landlord, have it in the form of personal property instead of real estate, particularly in some of your more densely populated cities, particularly the top. Man, the top 10 largest cities in the United States, property taxes are crazy. But I would look for small communities to do that in. Now, the next audio we're going to play is what they're doing over in China. They're doing it in other places, too, but they're making you got some people doing it over here, too. But and here's the thing. You can, like in the case of Laura, in the case of Lamar, in the case of Steve Shives, and Steve Shives, I love his story, because, and he's about 2 hours away from me here in Florida. Steve, well, basically all of them have backyard businesses. I mean, Laura didn't make hers into a business yet, but, I mean, this was a backyard project that Laura did at 11 years old. Lamar Alexander, backyard project, and he made a cabin. Steve Shives, he was living in, a traditional brick-and-mortar house, but he made his campers, runaway campers. That started out as a backyard business, and he's grown it into, you know, earning millions of dollars. So Let's see. Somebody's calling me. So let me play this. This is with the Chinese. We'll be back with you soon.
What's it like to live where you work? For most of us, that's unthinkable. But imagine living and working at one of the biggest factories in the world. A workplace the size of Monaco. For these 17,000 employees, it's reality. They come from all over China, seeking a brighter future at this factory called Yupa. Workers craft coffee makers, irons, and electric grills in staggering quantities every single day. But Yupa is more than a steady paycheck. It's home. People get married here. They send their kids to school here. But the work never stops. Yupa's managers are on a mission to produce new products for every corner of the globe that could forever change the way we think of made in China. Step behind the closed doors of modern China into a factory the size of a city. Welcome to the place that calls itself Factory of the World. By the time you finish watching this program, Yupa's 17,000 Chinese workers will produce nearly 20,000 electrical appliances. Every day they churn out 60,000 irons. Every month, Yupa makes 36,000 coffee makers. That's two new machines for every Starbucks on the planet. And every year, these laborers produce a staggering 18 million electric grills. Stacked side by side, they'd span the Atlantic from New York to London. Chances are you own something built right here. Factories like these don't exist in North America or Europe, but they're not uncommon in China, where labor is cheap. Yupa runs on human sweat alone. No need for robots. To ensure non-stop production, workers need a steady stream of parts. Someone has to make sure those parts get to the right place in time. This is Ming Long Pa. He started work at Yupa in 1994.
I'm in charge of production control. Production control is the brain of the factory. Its main function is to coordinate each department.
If any of Yupa's factories run out of parts, Mr. He's job is on the line.
The production line cannot wait. We have to guarantee that our production is smooth. Running out of materials would affect our efficiency, affect our productivity, and affect our revenue. So I have to fix this in the shortest time possible.
Today, a problem at the iron factory needs smoothing out. Workers on the iron line are low on a crucial part. To keep up production, they need 2,000 units, and they need them now.
Just now I found out the main problems here at the iron department. One major problem is the case for model 603. They need 2,000 right now.
Traditional plants use outside suppliers for their components, not Yupa. To slash costs and stay competitive, Yupa builds its own parts on site. So Mr. He's supplier is only a bike ride away. But even the supplier is dangerously low on stock.
Yeah. citizen.
Mr. He has found barely enough parts to last a day. When he gets another urgent call, now the grill factory is low on a crucial component. Grills are the company's most profitable products. Yupa started producing one line of grills in 1994. Now, 60 assembly lines churn out 800 different models. Workers make one grill every 12 seconds. That's 50,000 grills per day, or 1.5 million per month. Enough grills for every person in Dallas. Grills bring in $350 million a year. But Yupa wants more. Little wonder Lu Jinye acts like a general leading his troops to war. By next year, managers expect workers to crank out $500 million worth of grills. Yupa's profits have to rise to outmuscle the competition. Mr. Ye supervises 850 workers on 30 lines.
We have to coordinate all these workers and pull all their thoughts into one. It takes teamwork to accomplish our goals, to get the results we want.
Mr. Ye is obsessed with quality control. His aim? Boost output without compromising quality. In a factory this big, with a production run so massive, even the hyper-efficient Mr. Ye hits a roadblock.
This holder piece holds the grill plate. What we're seeing now is the assembly of this piece. The problem is the size. It's the wrong size.
They've run out of part number 2627. It attaches the core heating element to the frame. Without this simple component, assembly lines will shut down. Unless Mr. Ha finds a fresh supply. And soon.
If we don't get them the parts, 6 production lines will have to stop.
When every part is on hand, grills assemble like a simple puzzle. Wires are linked to the heating element, and the element is fixed to the plate.
When it's not locked down properly, it will fall off. If it falls off, it will burn the hands of our customers and consumers. This job is very important.
Then it's time to connect the power cord.
The brown wire is live and the green wire is neutral. The one with the writing on it matches the brown wire. Connect them and that makes the wire live.
Each grill is inspected for flaws in construction or appearance. Finally, every grill is tested to make sure everything is in working order. On a typical day, Mr. Ye's team must make 700 of Yupa's 50,000 grills. Missing parts cause delays, cost Yupa a fortune, and force workers into overtime to meet their quota. Finding the missing parts falls to Mr. Ha, and the pressure is on. Mr. He finally arrives, and he has good news. He's found 2,000 parts to keep the lines moving, and 50,000 more are on the way. Mr. He's day has ended on a high note. He heads home to a company-subsidized apartment only minutes away.
Mom,
His wife, Hong Zhang-Yu, also works for the plant. Together, they lead a life of relative luxury. Family life in China is a communal affair. His parents and his in-laws live here, thanks to Yupa. It's one more reason workers are fiercely loyal to their company.
Our products all have the Made in China tag. I hope our products can bring to consumers a sense of joy, a sense of it's worth it. This is my biggest wish.
Fulfilling that wish will come at a cost.
When I first arrived here, I didn't know anyone else, and we all have to live together. It was really tough in the beginning.
Yupa's next generation of workers must leave their families behind and devote their lives to the company. It's a place tourists never see. The new face of modern China. Competitive, hungry for profits, and ready to take on the world. Located near the city of Xiaomeng, the Yupa complex sprawls for 1.8 square kilometers, almost the size of Monaco.
We have about over 20 buildings here. You know, the largest building, you know, equal like 4 football fields. You can have 60 to 70 assembly lines. Each assembly line can have 25 to 35 workers in the line.
25 years ago, there were no factories here, only farms. In the 1980s, the Chinese government decided capitalism wasn't so bad after all. The communist regime established so-called special economic zones, designated places for free markets and foreign investments. Yupa, a Taiwanese company, moved here in 1988. In a few short years, it became the largest manufacturer of irons, electric grills, and espresso makers in the world. Yupa is a city unto itself, with restaurants and convenience stores, soccer fields and basketball courts, and living quarters for everyone from students to families. Success made it big, and size keeps it successful. Mass production runs push down costs. Almost all parts are made on-site, keeping supply costs low and parts within easy reach.
Because we are in this location pretty much isolated, we don't have satellite suppliers around us to build, you know, parts for us. So we had to do it in-house, and we had to do it in a large scale.
Yupa's main advantage is a cheap and endless labor force, ready to work for a fraction of a Western wage. 16-year-old Mao Fen Guo left her family and came here in 2008. But Guo isn't just looking for work. She's here to escape poverty and make her mother proud. In China, many parents prefer sons to daughters.
My mother has only 2 daughters. She's always upset about that. And in order to not let her down, I must work harder and harder.
Guo is a worker in training. With about 1,000 other students, she attends Yupa's on-site trade school. To get here, she had to pass entry exams and pay Yupa tuition. Now she's enrolled in 3 years of study and hands-on training at the factory. If she does well, Guo hopes for a job at Yupa.
At the very beginning, I thought it was very hard. But now that I've gone through all this, it's easier. There's a lot to learn, but I'm still full of confidence.
Today, she and her classmates are learning everything they ever wanted to know and more about irons. To get a job, Guo must learn the ins and outs of every product line.
We're changing constantly. Last time, we were making grills. Then we changed to coffee makers, and now electric irons.
Workers on 27 production lines pump out an iron every 15 seconds, and as many as 60,000 irons a day. Production includes at least 10 separate brands for dozens of companies. With over 30 steps to assembly, iron making is intricate work. And there's no room for error. Assembly starts with a water spray unit, made up of springs, rubber, and washers. With training and practice, it snaps into the spout in seconds.
If it's not closed tight, it will leak or blow. Then it won't work properly.
Now the sprayer and spout are joined to the handle. The two parts of the water reservoir are placed in a heating machine. That melts the space between them and makes the reservoir watertight.
Welding is an important part of production. However, it will be easy as long as we follow our operational guidelines.
Next, the thermostat is attached to the base.
You need to make sure you're using the correct format before you insert the base. Using a wrong base can lead to fire. Wiring is also important. Where there is a wiring mistake, there's hidden trouble.
A plastic buffer is placed between the heating element and the handle to keep the handle and the user's hand from getting too hot. After that, the plug is welded to the back of the iron.
We're connecting the wire for the power supply. I can do about 4 to 5 pieces every minute and 300 pieces an hour.
Once the spray and steam buttons are attached, it's testing time. First, the steam and squirting functions. Second, the iron's electrical system. Faulty units are either repaired or removed. Finally, irons that pass inspection are packed up and shipped away. The team won't cut corners or settle for second best. Today, Guo and her classmates will put classroom theory into practice and work the iron mine. For a teenager from a small town, living and working in a giant factory can be overwhelming.
My life is not as hard as it was before. I'm getting used to this place now.
Work on the iron line goes better than expected. For Guo, juggling work and school isn't that difficult. The hard part is leaving family and living far from home.
I guess it's learning how to be independent. When I first arrived here, I didn't know anyone else, and we all have to live together. It was really tough in the beginning.
Like China, Guo is adapting to a new world of high technology and tough international competition. And like China itself, she's determined to succeed.
I don't see myself working on the production line forever, doing the same job. Maybe I'm a bit arrogant or too confident about myself, but I want a better future.
For some people, a better future keeps them married to their job. Workers at Yupa are married to the company. Based in southeast China, Yupa is one of the biggest factories on the planet. Today and every day, its 17,000 workers are getting the world ready for breakfast. In the next 24 hours, it will produce 1,200 conventional coffee makers. Over the next 30 days, these assembly lines will deliver 210,000 cappuccino espresso machines. In the space of 1 year, nearly 2.5 million coffee makers will pour out of Yupa and into the kitchens of the world. At the center of all this is Young Lee.
We already have 200 or 300 styles.
and we develop and add over 40 new styles every year.
Lee's mandate is crucial and broad. Tackle any problem that could slow down non-stop production.
We have to make every effort to find these problems and to solve them. We have to make sure that every process is working perfectly. Manufacturing shouldn't be delayed because of these problems.
Today, he's got a brand new kind of problem. One of Yupa's big clients has designed a new coffee maker. It's up to Lee to build a working prototype to entice the client into going ahead with mass production. Hundreds of Yupa jobs and millions of dollars in potential business are now in Lee's hands.
Making prototypes is a large portion of my job and is vitally important to the development of the company.
Lee starts by assembling the heating system for the water and steam. Then he carefully places it into the main body. Just when Lee's ready to assemble it all, there are parts missing. The supplier is just a walk away, a long walk, but Lee doesn't mind the distance. Someone special is waiting for him at the supply depot. The person helping him today is his girlfriend. These perks make Yupa more than a place of work. With a workforce of 17,000, many of them married with kids, this factory city turns office space into personal space.
Sometimes we work together. For example, if we need the help from the technician to solve production problems, then we meet each other afterwards.
Li Yang Li works in the parts supply department. She first came to Yupa in 2004.
We fell in love at first sight. I always think it must be God who makes her work here and wait for me. Even now, I still think the same.
Yupa management encourages these intimate connections. They believe couples that work together are more loyal to the company.
By working in the same company, we can go to work together and take care of each other. We can see each other more often. What's more, we can be with each other when we have a problem.
With the missing parts in hand, Lee is ready for wiring. Making it all fit into the chamber isn't easy.
I will have to organize all the electrical wires properly to make sure the coffee maker operates safely.
But the real test will come after shipping. If the client approves of Lee's model, Yupa could get a massive order. If it doesn't, hundreds of jobs are on the line.
If I make the prototype in a sloppy way, our customers will lose confidence in the quality of our products. It will be a great loss to our company.
Weeks later, Lee's model is approved for mass production. And right away, he sets out to create a brand new production line. It takes a week to prepare the assembly line and train the workers to make the new coffee machine.
Making a coffee maker is not an easy job at all. It requires professional knowledge and a profound understanding of coffee culture.
When the prep is done, Factory City springs into action and works with astonishing speed. Lee's prototype took half a day to make. Now line workers churn out 700 machines a day. Lee's shift is done, and when work ends at Factory City, romance begins.
When we're done work, we normally go shopping together or take a walk. It gives us a sense of happiness.
The couple plan to get married at a mass wedding, paid for and organized by the company. All at once, dozens of Yupa workers will tie the knot, while thousands of co-workers look on.
If we take part in the group wedding, with the best wishes of all of our co-workers here, we know we will be getting married in the factory of the world, one dream, and that would be unforgettable.
A mass wedding is the couple's way of showing their love for each other and their passion for Yupa. Chef Xing Ming Li has a passion of his own, feeding the 17,000 workers that power the factory of the world. At Factory City, the day has barely begun. But Chef Xing Ming Li already faces his first daily deadline. Li runs one of five independent restaurants at Yupa. Competition between them is intense. Profits are razor thin, and Li needs thousands of customers every day just to survive. In his eyes, he's not just serving meals, he's fueling the workers that power the factory of the world.
If they don't eat well, or eat enough, they won't have enough energy. Then they won't perform well at Yupa.
It all starts with fresh ingredients. Beef, pork, bok choy, onions, carrots, and winter melon.
We have all fresh seasonal vegetables here. Whatever you can find from the food market, you can find here.
Everything is washed, sliced, and diced. Yupa churns out millions of kitchen appliances a year. But there are no food processors in Lee's kitchen. Nothing is automated. Everything is done by hand. By 9 a.m., Lee's staff is already racing against the clock.
We'll have to finish everything before 11 o'clock because Yupa staff restaurants all open at 11:30. We have to be there in advance.
In 2 hours, 3,000 workers will stop by for lunch. Li expects just as many for dinner. This means his staff of 50 must serve 6,000 meals by sunset. That's 125 kilograms of oil, 50 kilograms of beef, and 300 kilograms of pork. That's more than 1 million tons of food every year. His chefs turn stock ingredients into hundreds of delicious dishes.
We can make different cuisines. Our chefs are all the best of their hometown.
They cook up dishes from Fujian, Sichuan, and Henan regions, and they'll soon add halal fare for Muslim clients.
I believe everything that we cook should taste like what your mom cooks for you at home.
Lee's obsession with food comes from growing up hungry.
My family was very poor. Although my dad was working very hard to earn money, we still didn't have much food to eat.
Now food is never in short supply, and all of Lee's clients return to work with their bellies full. Lee's passion for food has made him a perfectionist. He hunts the market for produce that's perfectly ripe and reasonably priced. In his kitchens, Lee controls the cooks, and no dish goes out without his approval.
Too bland. Some salt and chicken stock will make it taste better.
The special today is spicy Sichuan pork.
Actually, anyone can cook. The key is our chefs make their own special seasonings that you can't get from the market.
Lee insists the pork must be extremely fresh. He expects perfect timing from every cook.
Timing is what the chefs are really good at, but they may not be willing to share that information.
But now it's almost 10 a.m., and Lee's kitchen is about to hit the boiling point. With the clock ticking, the team of chefs are stir-frying and stewing to feed an army.
It might be a bit of an exaggeration to say that it's a battlefield, but it's true that we're really busy. We have to finish everything within 1 hour. Then we will deliver them to our restaurants. We don't have time to do other things.
By 11 a.m., they pull it off. Dozens of different dishes for 3,000 people and right on time. Drivers rush the dishes to the restaurant nearby. Competition between the five independent restaurants at Yupa keeps quality and choice high and prices low. Workers pay about 50 cents per meal, thanks to a company subsidy. To turn a profit, thousands of customers must pass through Lee's door each day. But it's not profits that keep Lee up at night. More than anything, he wants people to enjoy his food.
I've experienced a lot of sleepless nights. I often blame myself for the mistakes that occurred in the daytime. I should have done better.
So far, his customers look happy. After lunch, while workers crank out appliances, Lee will be planning dinner, determined to satisfy his next 3,000 customers.
I hope that Yupa and everyone else will trust me and become my friends. I'll be content if they all come to dine in my restaurant.
If feeding workers at the factory of the world is tough, try being the guy who must make everyone get along. In this factory city, 17,000 people live and work inside 1.8 square kilometers. Rush hour is a human traffic jam. Just getting to work on time is a job well done. Inside these walls, office politics and conflicts play out on a massive scale. The man managing all this human friction could have Yupa's toughest job of all. Now in his second year on the job, Ya Shin Fu is the manager of Yupa's service department. His job, address anything that affects the day-to-day life of Yupa's 17,000 workers.
I have to find a balance between the costs of the company and the needs of the employees. Too little and the employees will be dissatisfied. Too much and the company won't be happy, so it's a big challenge.
Keeping Yupa's army of laborers in line is no small task. At this regular weekly meeting, Fu is boosting company morale.
Leading them is like raising children. We have to raise them with love.
Yupa's workers come from every corner of China. Most are in their 20s and 30s. They work on average 40 hours a week and make between 90 and 320 US dollars a month. While wages are even higher in big cities like Shanghai, many Yupa workers make double what they did back home if they had any work there at all. As with any mass organization, thousands of employees create endless demands. It's Mr. Fu's job to address all of them. He does everything he can to keep everyone motivated and committed to staying at the factory of the world. Fu visits staff living quarters as part of his regular rounds.
We're now going to the workers' dormitory. I routinely go there to check if anything can be improved. If there is, I will talk to the superintendent.
Fu is part landlord and part tenants' rights advocate. Today, he's ensuring Yupa rooms are ready for a group of new workers. Average rent is only $6 per month, but the type of accommodation depends on a worker's rank and the amount of money they are willing to part with. Fu is paying a visit to Mao Fen Guo, who has a noise complaint. Fu believes that to build quality products, Yupa's workers must be well rested and well fed.
The challenge is that there are 17,000 employees and they come from all over China. Everyone has different tastes. I have to take care of everybody.
Yupa's restaurants are extremely competitive, and some have been known to skimp on meat portions to keep costs low. Yupa has strict rules about when and where vendors can sell their food. Fu keeps them in line.
Now we are going to check on the other restaurants. We have designated areas for them. If they break the rules, I will kick them out.
These vendors aren't trespassing. They work for the factory's restaurants. But they are breaking the rules by selling food too close to rival restaurants. Everyone must have a permit. A veteran on these streets, Fu recognizes this woman. He busted her once before. Today, Fu lets everyone off with a warning. Next time, he may ban them from selling food at Yupa.
I talk to them, but they will break the rules again, so I have to check on them every day.
China's web of cultures complicates Fu's job.
Everyone comes from different families and different provinces, so their customs of eating and living are totally different, so I have to adapt to them.
But one thing unites all of Yupa's workers, the world's most popular sport. On the field, tension and stress vanish.
Because employees are undergoing a lot of pressure at work, we have to give them an outlet and let them exercise. But most important is the team building.
Don't care for soccer? Yupa offers other ways for workers to get their exercise.
For entertainment, we have ball game competitions like basketball, table tennis, and other games. These sorts of competitions.
It's all part of Fu's mission at one of the world's biggest factories. A place with no boundaries between work and life. For Fu, it's a never-ending battle to keep the peace and to keep the company together.
It really is a miracle. A company this big, with all the employees together, holding hands and moving forward. This is not easy.
And while there may be harmony inside Yupa's walls, outside, competition is cutthroat. In a global market, innovation is key. Yupa's employees must endure tough changes to survive. In the global marketplace, there's no room for second best. To survive, companies need a competitive edge. Like most China-based companies, Yupa has relied on low labor costs, making products designed by others. But it wants to move up the production food chain. Yupa's leaders want to design products of their own. They have little choice. To thrive and survive, Yupa must develop a new generation of products. The factory's very existence depends on it. Thousands of jobs hang in the balance.
No work means not being able to live. This is a fundamental requirement. It's how humans survive. You have to earn money to make a living, and to earn money, you have to work.
Ji Rong Pan knows how high the stakes are. He is Yupa's Vice President of Product Innovation.
I think innovation is the competitive edge of our company. Because our company is in the field of home appliances and the whole home appliance industry is a lifestyle industry.
Mr. Pan sent his staff overseas to study the lifestyle products of the future. They returned with a simple message. The future is green.
We studied the consumers of North America and Europe and their thoughts on this new energy of the future. So we know that their love of the earth is actually very strong.
Pan and his designers make a bold decision. The first appliance in Yupa's new product line will be powered by the sun. It's a solar CD player.
We want to bring this clean solar energy concept into people's homes.
Going solar may sound easy, but solar panels are expensive, and they're meant to work outside, not in the dim corners of people's homes. A 3D image of Yupa's appliance of the future starts to emerge. Now the team must turn a digital design into reality.
This factory is a very important part of our development process. It helps turn a product concept into a finished prototype.
Using the design specs, a computerized milling machine cuts a foam cast. And the cast is converted into a hard plastic prototype. If things go according to plan, the model will be used to produce millions of identical copies.
It allows us to test the product to see if this fulfills our requirements while bringing value to the customers.
Now engineers perfect the solar power system. The system must collect and store solar energy. Every aspect of design must maximize energy efficiency.
We've spent a lot of time studying this. What kind of technology, what kind of material, what kind of parts can help us improve our energy efficiency?
Finally, Yupa's product of the future is revealed. The solar CD player is simple and elegant. The player will charge indoors when left near a window. And the system is uniquely versatile. It will work with any energy-efficient appliance Yupa designs. But one question remains. Will the world embrace Chinese solar products?
We want to bring what people originally thought of as an industrial thing and truly integrate it into their daily lives to enable consumers to truly experience solar energy. This is a very magical energy concept.
If these innovative products succeed, Yupa could achieve its dream, a dream it shares with China, to be the factory of the world.
I want consumers and everyone to have faith in our products and faith in the workers. I hope everyone can enjoy the products we produce. This will make us proud.
With Factory City in full swing and new products in the works, more and more goods will carry the Made in China label. But for China and Factory City, growth comes at a cost. Every day, the 17,000 people at Yupa endure the stress and uncertainty of a cutthroat world economy. To fight off fierce competitors and build a better life, these men and women work and live together as one at the factory of the world.